Okay, so I am here with Toby Ball, who is most recently the author of The Vaults. Toby, it's a pleasure that we could do this. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
The one thing I noticed about this book is that there is a great concern for sound and voice, more so than you get in usually in pulp. And I'm wondering why that is. Do you have a background in music or sound, or was old-time radio more of an influence than pulp novels? I'm just kind of curious about this.
That is an interesting question, and I don't know if I have a real answer for it.
Yeah.
In that I do not have a background in anything like that. My background is essentially working at a magazine and then teaching and working in nonprofits. So I honestly don't know, other than sort of envisioning things before writing them. I think that's part of the imaginative process is trying to be fully engulfed in that experience, and part of that is sound, and trying to get enough of that in there to give a sense of what the people are experiencing. And in a certain to a certain extent, it's trying to create somewhat disorienting scenes, and hopefully the sound is sometimes not completely consistent with what you'd expect from the other descriptions of sort of the physical presences.
But it is interesting how the voice, somebody's voice, tends to be imposing more so than, say, the bigness of Big Henry and the like.
Okay.
And that's why it's very interesting to me that sound seems to be the linchpin, particularly in light of the fact that the technology in this book is rather interesting. I mean, here we are, roughly around 1935 in your sort of little parallel universe, and we don't really have motion pictures, which is very interesting. We have some possible version of photography with the replacement system that comes with the vaults. And so that's why it is very interesting to me that sound is such an important quality. It's almost as if sound in your world matters more than image, just to a large degree.
It's an interesting idea. And I think, a lot of the book is about information and, both the information that is sort of overt, and then there's a certain amount of information that has to be kind of gleaned from other pieces of information. And I think, particularly the idea that people can assert power in ways other than physically or through violence or through having, political power or whatever. And I think that sometimes comes through sort of with your ability to sort of dominate things vocally, maybe not even verbally. You don't have to necessarily have a great way with words, but if you can, take up more space around you than the person, it's sort of a alpha male thing, I guess.
Well, did you pre-think any of the technology in the book, or for that matter, any of the history? I mean, we do have allusions to the Great War. We have, of course, the birthday party massacre, which is both a funny and a grisly idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me wonder whether you had any sort of master plan for this alternative history, or you kind of just were inventing things and filling in the gaps as you went along.
Well, what I was most interested in, I think, was the idea of how do you organize information. And because of that, it had to be before a certain period, say the 1960s. And so kind of moving it back to the 30s and sort of combining it with sort of these ideas we have about, the 20s and 30s gangs and things like that. I think that was sort of the first step in doing it. But I also wanted to create, sort of a complicated and...
Yes, Dad.
Busy. Hi.
Microphones? Yes, the microphones. You can get these microphones at just about any audio place. We have a child here who has decided to... Hi. What's your name?
Where'd you get that?
Well, we got these through... I got these through an audio supplier. So, but anyway...
Pretty cool.
Well, we have an audience.
Yeah. We have an audience of two. So from there, as I kind of wrote and sort of developed some more things I was interested in writing about, I think, and that's where things kind of move on to sort of what's the importance of having, accurate information? What's the value of that? What can you get by taking just sort of discrete facts and just simply by organizing them, by ensuring their purity? How does that in itself become information? And And so kind of trying to combine that with sort of the, you know, I think there's a certain fun aspect to the 20s and 30s where you can get this sort of, you know, noir-y feel about things, which, you know, is to a certain extent, the book has to be fun, too. I mean, you have to want to read it and the atmosphere and things like that.
Yeah.
Does that kind of answer your question?
It sort of does. I think what I'm also kind of curious about, since you are talking about information as a starting point, When did you drift off of this kind of focus on information and more into, I suppose, just telling a good old-fashioned pulp yarn? Yes, they do.
Yep, they work.
They work.
The genesis of the book is having this idea, which is based on an article that I had read in the 90s about the Berlin Document Center, which is a whole different story. But then... I also had this idea, and I don't want to give it away, but of this sort of conspiracy, and kind of combining the two of those, I think, in order to make it sort of work, you have to build up certain structures around it, which was, you know, a gigantic sort of corrupt city government, a history of, you know, a gang war and violence and things like that, and so that's, you know, it's a plot-heavy book, I think, you know, and so that as I thought about it, and some of it, you know, you make up as you kind of go along, you know, you get to a point, you're like, well, how do I get from this point to this point? You're trying to focus on, you know, plot points that'll work and that keep things interesting.
Well, near the end of the book, you have Van Vossen remarking that he was having a difficult time organizing the book, and I noticed that as the book went on, all of a sudden the chapters became much shorter. And suddenly I'm thinking, like, oh, man, he's really kind of writing himself out of a corner. Were you having problems organizing the information as you were writing this at all, or...?
No, you know, I knew where I was going, but I think as things, you know, early on in the book, I think you're trying to deliver so much information to kind of create the situation and create both the sort of milieu in which this is all taking place, and then the problems that each character is having, that towards the end, as you start to resolve these things, it seemed like there was less that you had to write around the actual plot itself. You could start resolving things both thematically and sort of plot-wise without all this other information that you're also giving.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope the impression you don't come away with is like, oh, okay, so this is how he's like, trying desperately to wrap up the...
Well, I only mention this, and this is one minor criticism of the book.
Okay.
The Nora chapters.
Yeah.
We frequently cut back to Nora, who is, you know, locked up and all that. And initially, you see, oh, well, she's going to use her sex appeal to leave the situation. Then it's, what book is she reading? So I almost got the sense, like, when I was reading this, like, oh, well... He has to remind us of Nora. It's almost almost a placeholder, but then she's not really doing anything until she actually escapes. So I thought it was funny because it was like we're going back to these very slim chapters involving Nora to remind the reader of Nora's presence. But on the other hand, you know, I'm wondering why you couldn't have other characters be concerned about Nora. I mean, you know, Nora has a boyfriend and all that. And so it was interesting to me that you felt the need to go back to the Nora chapters, even though she was sort of kind of trapped in this situation and not really doing anything until later.
Well, I my idea with Nora was that she gets into the situation where she really has no... she has no tools other than, you know, her own sort of sex appeal. And the idea, my thought behind her was that she's kind of trying to use it, but it's not something you can do very quickly. You know, she's trying to unsettle her captor, and that she's patient. And that was, I think that's what I was trying to get across in those chapters, is that when she's doing other things, it's more sort of the fact that she's not panicked. She kind of understands what she has to use, and she's patient enough to kind of, to think that I can work my way out of this instead of being, which, you know, I think you run into a lot in sort of pulp literature, is sort of this franticness of I've got to get out of here. And with her, she sort of accepts the fact that this is going to be kind of a long game and kind of goes with that. So going back to her, I think was trying to sort of keep in touch with her sort of mental aspect during these times when everybody else is kind of running around doing things. She's kind of stuck, and how she spends that time.
Yeah.
Both sort of alarmed but not panicked.
But why not give her something more to do than just waiting around and saying, oh, well, I don't have to worry about the spotlight being on me? Do you have problems with that? Or?
Well, I think, hopefully it comes back in the end where... Yep. Where when she finally does get away, she walks out and she's recognized, and she said, oh, you know, I realized that this was something I actually enjoyed, you know, being away from it. It wasn't so much that I missed it, but now that I'm back, I'm glad that I'm back on the street and people are looking at me and stuff like that. So, it's an interesting criticism, and I guess I don't have much of a response other than I didn't really think about it beyond sort of this arc where she was going to be sort of composed during this difficult time.
But on the other hand, a lot of pulp works that way, where you have a character who is sort of locked in a location, and again, it's one of these things that I don't think we see very often, unless, of course, you read like a hard case crime book these days, you know, someone who's just like, you know, trapped in a situation like that. If it was a criticism, it was also, to my mind, also a throwback to that kind of form of writing. And I'm wondering how much that figured into the late organization of your book.
Can you just clarify that? I'm trying to...
No, the shifting chapters where they became shorter.
Right.
How much of that was a throwback or homage or an attempt to either mimic or riff off of, you know, the pulp literature canon?
I guess maybe a little bit. I mean, not that intentional.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it... You know, I really kind of felt like the end, the pace needed to pick up a little bit.
Yes.
You know, it to a certain extent, you know, drawing out the resolution of things wasn't to the benefit of the story. So I did try and move things along quickly, and everything kind of resolves itself in a pretty brief period at the end.
Yeah.
You know, everything kind of like adds up on itself, and it was really just absolutely to the benefit of the story rather than some sort of conscious homage to, you know, Hammett or somebody like that.
Sure. Well, there's a later scene in the book where Puxis is attempting to determine what someone is typing. And this was interesting. It reminded me very much of a moment in Nicholson Baker's Room Temperature where you have the husband trying to see if he can actually tell what someone is writing by following the pen strokes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if that was direct homage or accidental, but I'm curious if that was rooted in any real research, the ability to sort of like observe and somehow get a message from a typewriter like that.
No, Puxis has got these two moments where he's kind of doing things that are kind of beyond sort of the norm.
Yeah.
And there's that one, and there's the one where at the very beginning where he's talking about the last time he took a vacation, you know, 18 years ago, and he starts filling in crosswords with just random letters, and then we'll fill them all out. And that was a part that I thought long and hard about whether I was comfortable with stepping away from, you know, sort of the intensely plausible, I think, to that point. But, in the end, I kind of felt like it was in keeping with that sort of very extremely obsessive character and the fact that he's not only obsessive, but has nothing else to do with his life other than pursue these obsessions. And because of that, is able to sort of order things in his mind in a way that somebody who had more distractions in his life probably would not, and that's sort of one manifestation of that.
Yeah.
is being able to, you know, keep track of keystrokes and where fingers are going and things like that. It's a little bit of extreme.
Well, I mean, how important really is it to be real? I mean, you established from the get-go that this is a quirky universe. Therefore, by the rules of your book, you can kind of suspend disbelief quite a bit and have a lot of fun. I mean, you know, you've got the whole situation with the polls. You've got a mayor who is essentially terrorizing someone out of a window. That's not exactly something that one would expect to happen in 1935.
Right.
So how much is reality shouldn't even matter if you're setting the rules up for something else here?
Right. Well, I guess I guess I took a look at the society as being something that I could definitely play with, like the city. The people I tried to keep within the realm of, you know, some reasonable expectation of what human beings would do.
Sure.
I mean, the Red Henry dangling the union leader out the window is actually, I think Suge Knight did that to Vanilla Ice. I think that was the story.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I pulled that from. I sort of randomly, I thought that was kind of an interesting...
Suge Knight, though, wasn't a politician.
That's true. It's not
that
in
is
a conventional
an interesting
sense.
Influence, yeah.
I think suspension of disbelief was something that I thought about quite a bit while I was writing this book, and even, you know, the idea that you're having an anonymous city, just called the city, instead of like making it set in Chicago or St. Louis or something like that. I mean, again, it's like, at what distance do you want people to be from reality, and is it, you know, is suspension of disbelief harder when you're just having this anonymous city with all this stuff that's just sort of purely coming out of thin air, or is like having a place in Chicago with names that you recognize and things like that?
Yeah.
But we're also saying, you know, was Chicago really like that in the 1920s and 1930s, and trying to sort of understand how much of this is true and how much of it is not? You know, that I don't think that's really an issue in the vaults, but it is something that I. In both this book and in the two books that follow it, it was sort of something that I would think long and hard about in certain aspects of the plot and in certain scenes. Is like, how far do I want to really push this?
Yeah, but from the get-go, you decide upon the city. I mean,
right.
I became so curious. I was trying to look at the street names, and I noticed that, for example, Copernik, Stanislaus, and Pierce. You can find those streets in Buffalo, New York.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if you plucked particular street names from Buffalo or from maps or from directories. I mean, was there any specific city that you had in mind, or were you just plucking cities where you kind of kicked about in your youthful folly or whatnot?
Well, I grew up in Syracuse, which is a very, ethnically diverse city. And so in some ways it's like Syracuse times, you know, 35 or something. But like Copernik is actually in Amsterdam, New York. Yep. We have a summer place. We drive from Syracuse to sort of central New Hampshire, and we drive through Amsterdam, New York. And Copernik and Stanislaus are two of the streets that we went on.
Yeah.
But I was sort of consciously trying to, I mean, I wrote quite a bit of this right at the, right after 9/11. And in New Hampshire, at least, there was this funny kind of patriotism going on. And I think the sort of classic example is, on the way home, I drive past this candy store, and it had this marquee out front. And it usually said, you know, 1 pound of fudge, $5.99 or something. And after 9/11, it had this sign that said, America, love it or get the hell out. You know? And it was just kind of, you know, it's a little jarring.
Yeah.
And so as I was sort of envisioning the city and also thinking about Syracuse and things like that, but it's like a real city of you know, sort of a polyglot city. You know, it's people from all over coming to this one city and trying in some way to exist next to each other. And this at a time when New Hampshire, which is, you know, pretty homogeneous, you know, if you get past the sort of Irish, English, and French ancestry, you know, that seemed to be on a lot of people's minds. It's like, what's really an American? So that's something, I mean, it's not like a major theme, but as I was kind of envisioning the city and the milieu in which this all happened, that was definitely something that was on my mind.
Yeah. The anti-subversive unit would seem to be a direct response to 9/11, but this is interesting because you have two other books, you say.
Yeah.
I wonder, did you write all three of those books before you had a deal for the vaults?
No.
No, okay.
I'd written part of the second book, which is coming out in August. And then actually after the vaults were sold, I went back and took a look at it, and I said, you know, there's maybe 10% of this is salvageable.
Huh.
So I started all over again. And the third book I didn't really have. I had sort of a basic theme in mind, but I didn't have the
Yeah.
It wasn't in the can by any stretch of the imagination.
Was Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle influence? Because I note that Frings has a marijuana situation. He's very much into smoking pot everywhere, and this reminded me very much of like the pot smoking that goes on in The Man in the High Castle. I don't know if that was a conscious.
You know, I've never read that.
Oh, really?
I've taken it out of the library a few times, along with some other books, and for whatever reason, I just return it without reading it.
Have you read any Philip K. Dick? Or?
Yeah, you know, I've read a few. The Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said, or whatever that one is. And Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
Yeah.
And then one of the one of his later ones where the late pink laser beam that gives him information.
Oh, yeah.
So I really like Philip K. Dick. I haven't read as much of him as I would like to. But, you know, Frings's marijuana use has some specific kind of plot elements in the vaults. And that was part of it. It also just seemed, you know, he sort of envisioned as sort of a bohemian type character who's kind of in between some different cultures in the city, and this is one thing that he kind of shares with different groups of people who he's around.
Well, it serves almost two functions. One, well, there's the dream versus reality feel that I think is in this book, but second, it also reminds the reader who's familiar with, of course, Hearst and the, you know, criminalization of marijuana, that this is a time right before that.
Right.
Is this world, in fact, going to steer in the close to the world that we know, where pot is illegal, or is it actually going to flourish elsewhere? Similarly, I mean, while we're on the subject of how your world reflects and veers from reality, I was curious about Little Lisbon. And the polls. I mean, you have Little Lisbon instead of Little Italy. 1935, there's a lot of stuff going on in Europe, but you don't mention the Germans, you have the polls. And you don't mention Italy, you have Little Lisbon. So I'm wondering why you steered away from any reference to World War II, or in this world, is there even World War II? That's I think, the takeaway, I suspect. You have the polls going to the city, you know, and it's kind of a sort of rural-like industrialization. You know, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, maybe the Poles are the aggressors. Maybe there's some, you know, something going on there. Is there some larger global situation that's reflected in the next two books, or that you had in mind for this? Or
yeah, I envision the city as being almost a sort of hermetically sealed environment where people are occasionally let in, but and sort of follows the larger flows, I guess, of history and society. You know, my sort of assumptions were that basically the same things were happening. Like, the Poles were coming here because they were worried, you know, that the Germans were about to come in, and they wanted to move their factories to America where they thought they'd be safer. And I guess as you go further along in the books, like the next book, which is called Scorched City, is concerned a lot with kind of anti-communism.
Yeah.
Religious fundamentalism, civil rights, you know, racism to a certain extent. So I think these sort of larger societal and sort of world politic things sort of play on the city, but the city in itself is somewhat immune to sort of the actual, you know, you're not worried about the city being bombed or Russian spies running around the city or things like that. They're more sort of reflective of larger things, but it's taken care of within that little space, which is the city, or big space, I guess.
So as far as the reader and the characters are concerned, it's just the city and nothing really beyond that. Does confining your narrative to a city allow you to confine your ideas to a certain territorial limitations that will help you in kind of corralling the many ideas that come into your head? Or,
well, I think that's an interesting question. I guess it does sort of limit the scale. I mean, the one I guess exception to everything basically taking place in the city is in both the vault and in Scorched City, there are a couple of episodes where people go outside the city to get some kind of information. And in Scorched City, it's more sort of emotional, sort of ideological information rather than a series of facts. You know, in some ways I kind of view it as a movie, where all the action kind of takes place in one area. You don't need to move outside of it to get other things. You don't have to have characters going to a different city, or people coming from the outside to kind of influence things. But again, it's sort of this hermetically sealed environment. People have to kind of confront issues and resolve them within that environment. And that, I think that's both, you know, it raises some problems, but it also gets rid of some problems. I guess it kind of confines the scope of what you're dealing with.
Yeah. Does world building come, for you at least, more from the expression of distinct character or from these limitations that we're talking about? I think, for example, of Puxis, who has a very particular vernacular. He says a line like, "I suspect there may be people down there who are eager to come up," which is a very peculiar formalistic approach to dealing with a situation.
Right.
You know, so I'm wondering if, to what degree the characters are more responsible for the complexities of this world, as opposed to, you know, you had alluded to later books containing more political themes. And this has, of course, the unions, communism, corruption, newspapers and the like. What works, or do they kind of work in tangent with each other?
I hope they work kind of together. But I would say if you had to balance it on one side or the other, I think the characters, to a certain extent, drive a little bit of the way the city is described. And part of it is because you're only describing the part of the city in which they're concerned with.
Yeah.
So that you're only kind of, you know, if you're looking at this as like kind of a travelogue, you're only experiencing the places that they actually go or have some concern with. That being said, like a place like the Hollows, which is this sort of vast area of the city that's essentially been abandoned, that is somewhat thematic, but it's also, you know, maybe cinematic. I'm not exactly sure what word I want to use, but it's trying to give you this idea of this huge area in which some places just get abandoned sometimes. They just get let go. And
you set yourself up for spatial possibilities.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. But when I first envisioned the Hollows, part of it was in reaction to, I think it was a tidal wave or flooding in India.
Yeah.
And the Indian government's response was, you know, it happens, you know, and we just don't have the resources to deal with it, you know, and we just kind of got to, you know, we got to let it go.
Yeah.
And so then as I kind of process that through the lens of the book, it's like, you know, what if there's a city which is just so big and so unmanageable that at times you just let entire neighborhoods, you just let them go, you know, you stop services to them, people leave them, and then you just let the buildings just sit there and they're just kind of there.
Sujnite, India. The sense I'm getting is that many of the ideas in this book come from the headlines and are then transmutated through a prism for this book. How much of this is just complete, just made up?
There's some stuff made up. I mean, I think some of the visual type stuff is made up. Like, certainly there's a scene where it's basically snowing ash.
Yeah.
And that wasn't something that I'd read about anywhere.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, I read a lot of newspaper, magazine, stuff like that, keep up with current events. And I think a lot of it, you know, trying to take some of those ideas and themes and you know, not making them major plot points, but kind of working them in, because I find them interesting. They're interesting things for me to think about and write about, hopefully in a way that kind of makes sense within the framework of the story.
Yeah.
And I'm also, and hopefully this comes across, kind of interested in the idea that, you know, governments and societies just at some point just abandon people.
Yeah.
And that is sort of, well, you know, you're left to your own devices. And in the vaults, you know, there's this whole, you know, society that they're in these empty warehouses where they're just trying to get by as best they can because they've been abandoned.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting here is that you are very conscious of taking some pre-existing fact or some pre-existing story or some pre-existing rumor and turning it into something else for your book, which is why I had asked the question of, like, well, how much of this is just relying upon the subconscious and just whatever flies, or is there an active discovery later, like, oh, shit, I took that from this particular article or something like that.
Yeah. That's funny. What was interesting is I that the absolutely what you described moment was I had read this article about the Berlin Document Center that was written by Gerald Posner in the mid-90s. And that was the idea behind like this huge repository of information about the sort of metadata aspects to it. And when I went back and reread it after The Vaults was published, because I figured I'd probably be talking about the article sometimes, there's just like these little details that clearly stuck in my mind. Like there's like green ink has a part to play in the vaults, and that when you go back and you read the article, it's like, oh yeah, you know. Actually, Himmler used a green pen, and that was one of the things they were worried about losing was this kind of metadata. So, you know, that article apparently stuck with me quite a bit in my subconscious. So when I went back and read it, I was like, oh, there are these odd little details like, that made their way into the book. I mean, I don't want to make it sound as if everything is some kind of reflection of something that happened. But there is a fair amount of that stuff, but then things like, you know, the strike and the strike busting and the stuff that has to do with the mental asylums and the asylum that's connected to the convent and things like that, that's all kind of pulled out of the fevered imagination, I guess.
You worked as a journalist, and I think that some of that is actually in this book. I mean, some of the description of the side characters, such as Peja, which is Red Henry's secretary, a squat young man with slick back hair and slightly crossed eyes. And, of course, there's the Gazette itself, which, of course, reflects a newspaper culture. I'm wondering to what degree newspapers were an influence both conceptually and also in terms of these little shorthand character descriptions of even little side characters like that.
Yeah, when I worked in Congressional Quarterly, and I wasn't actually a reporter. I worked in the new media, but I did get a sense of I was in the culture, and there's sort of an in between where people think about like Woodward and Bernstein as these who are essentially investigators, and then the people who cover City Hall. I mean, there's a whole lot of people who are reporters who are trying to get to the truth of matters that aren't quite as grave as Watergate and things like that, but they're essentially the only people who are doing it. And that was with Frings, that was part of the idea, is that he kind of falls into this middle ground where he's trying to make sense of, you know, things that happen in a city, but he's not a detective, he's not a stenographer, but he falls somewhere in the middle.
And he's more of an op-ed guy, too.
Yeah, he's more of an op-ed. He's very opinionated. Yeah. He's a socialist. And he becomes more so as the books kind of progress. And I guess it gives me a sense, it also gave me a sense of, you know, what are some of these support type people and how do they act and sort of the different little subtle power relationships between people. And also, you know, these little characters you want to make memorable, but not spend a whole lot of time describing. You know?
Such as like Red Henry's mistress reading Nietzsche at one point.
Right, exactly.
A little detail goes a long way towards sticking in the reader's craw.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's certainly the hope.
Yeah.
Is that you can read a couple lines and be like, oh yeah, I've kind of got a sense of what that person's like without my having to give, you know, a big background or a huge physical description or whatever, talk about where they're coming from. Just like, oh yeah, that's the Nietzsche girl, you know, and that brings with it a certain assumptions.
Yes. Oh yeah, actually, I wanted to talk about description really quick. Between the three men who Puxis confronts, they define the states that a body takes when deprived of physical activity. And then you have this really interesting opening in chapter 23, which features this sentence in the opening paragraph. On days when the atmospheric conditions were right, the ash would fall on the northeast corner of the city like gray and black snow. We had mentioned this moment earlier. This quirky comparative description, which is almost consequential, I'm wondering where it comes from. I mean, the sense I'm getting is that you are plucking quite a bit from real facts, but I think that with these two aspects, you're also very interested in tight consequential corners with which to describe the action. How does something like this arise?
I feel like before I write a chapter or a scene, you know, I for at least the best ones, I feel like I very strongly visualize what's going on, and then the sort of challenge is how do you describe what you see in a way that's interesting, isn't overbearing.
Yes.
You know, I think I do make a conscious effort not to spend a whole lot of time on description. So, for instance, with those three men, you know, hopefully I'm describing three people in a couple of sentences, but giving you sort of a sense not only of each other physically, but sort of what the collective whole is like.
Yeah.
At least that was the objective. So that kind of stuff is really kind of, I think, comes from that is sort of an imagination type thing. It's just trying to visualize in a very detailed way what you're writing about before you sort of address the word processor, and then trying to find some concise yet interesting way of putting it across.
This concern for overbearing prose, I mean, this is a pulp book on
right.
some level, so how much is too much?
Right, and I think that's the thing that you always run into.
Yeah.
And what's I tend to write, I mean, from when I was in ninth grade, you know, I was always getting on my English papers, give me more,
yeah.
describe this more. And I tend to add more. I mean, what you get in the book is much more fleshed out than like my first draft will be. I mean, I think just I'm sort of, for whatever reason, I'm sort of programmed to write sparely. And
yeah.
then I have to kind of add more and more and more. But Elmore Leonard, I think one of his rules for writing is the parts that you don't read, leave them out.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely something I keep in mind. I don't have a whole lot of rules for writing, but that's what I'm always thinking about is, does this really need to be here?
Yeah.
And therefore my sort of descriptions of things tend to be fairly limited,
yeah.
you know.
But on the other hand, I mean, I recently reread James M. Cain's The Postman Always Rings twice for like
yeah.
the first time in 15 years, right? And the thing that gets me now about that book is how really savage and over the top and operatic that book is. I mean, you know, you've got Cora basically saying, rip me. And it's like, it's so, I mean, on some level it's ridiculous, but in the context of the book, it works.
Right.
So therefore, this is why I'm sort of, you know, interested in why you are concerned with going over the top, because in Cain's case, I think it was a matter of rhythm. If you
right.
have a rhythm that is working for the reader, then you could almost get away with anything.
Right, right.
What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, and I feel like I pushed things to the point where I wanted to push them. Like I don't think I had the desire to do that kind of, you know, rip me, punch me, all that. I mean that wasn't really sort of one of the goals I was after.
But a mayor is hanging the union leader out of the window. So.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true,
so
I guess.
I got to say here.
you got a point there. It's an interesting question. And I think, and maybe in the later books, I do push it a little bit more. I mean, I think certainly the second book, you know, there is a more, not necessarily graphic, but sort of overt violence, overt threat of violence on a larger scale. And things like that. I don't know. I mean, I again with the vaults, I don't feel like I left out things that I wanted to put in, and I am kind of conscious of dead spots, I guess. I mean, I don't feel like my strength as a writer is writing long detailed descriptions of things. I think I'm much stronger at writing a couple sentences to give you a strong sense of something, but then just moving on to concerns of the story, and hopefully there's a rhythm there. I mean, that's certainly the goal. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it totally does.
Okay.
I think I'm just trying to just think your thoughts there, but that works. But I think that's a good note to close on. Speaking of rhythm, and
okay.
Toby, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay.